4. London's Calling. 1. Red London. The city was under siege. Rye stood on the uppermost balcony of the palace and watched the forces assemble. The cold air bit at his cheeks and tugged on his half-cloak, catching it up like a golden flag behind him. Far below, structures collided, walls rose, and the sounds of stoked fires and hammer-on-steel echoed like weapons struck together in a barrage of wood and metal and glass. It would surprise most to know that when Rye thought of himself as king, he saw himself like this. Not on a throne, or toasting friends at lavish dinners, but overseeing armies. And while he had never seen an actual battlefront, the last true war was more than 60 years past, and his father's forces always smothered the border flares and civil skirmishes before they could escalate, Rye was blessed with enough imagination to compensate. And at first glance, London did appear to be under attack, though the forces were all his own. Everywhere Rye looked, the city was being overtaken, not by enemy soldiers, but by masons and magicians, hard at work constructing the platforms and stages, the floating arenas and bankside tents that would house the Essentosh and his competitors. "The view from up here," said a man behind him, "it is magnificent." The words were high royal, but their edges were smoothed out by the Ostra's Arnesian accent. "It is indeed, Master Parlow," said Rye, turning toward the man. He had to bite back a smile. Parlow looked positively miserable, half frozen and obviously uncomfortable with the distance between the balcony and the Red River far below, clutching the scrolls to the flowery pattern of his vest as if they were a rope. "Almost as bad as Vis." The guard stood with his armored back, pressed against the wall, looking pale. Rye was tempted to lean back against the railing just to make the Ostra and the guard nervous. It was something Kell would do. Instead, he stepped away from the edge, and Parlow gratefully mirrored his action by retreating a pace into the doorway. "What brings you to the roof?" asked Rye. Parlow drew a roll of parchment from under his arm. "The arrangements for the opening ceremonies, Your Highness." "Of course." He accepted the plans, but didn't unroll them. Parlow still stood there, as if waiting for something. A tip? A treat? And Rye finally said, "You can go now." The Ostra looked wounded, so Rye dredged up his most princely smile. "Come now, Master Parlow, you've been excused, not banished. The view up here may be magnificent, but the weather is not, and you look in need of tea and a fire. You'll find both in the gallery downstairs." "I suppose that does sound nice, but the plans?" "Hopefully I won't need help deciphering a scheme I'd made myself, and if I do, I know where to find you." After a moment, Parlow finally nodded and retreated. Rye sighed and set the plans on a small glass table by the door. He unrolled the parchment, wincing as sunlight made the page glow white, his head still throbbing dully from the night before. The nights had grown harder for Rye. He'd never been afraid of the dark, even after the shadows came and tried to kill him in the night, but that was because the dark itself used to be empty. Now it was not. He could feel it, whatever it was, hovering in the air around him, waiting until the sun went down and the world got quiet. Quiet enough to think. Thoughts. Those were the waiting things, and once they started up, he couldn't seem to silence them. Saints, how he tried. He poured himself a glass of tea and dragged his attention back to the plans, setting weights at the corners against the wind. And there it was, laid out before him, the thing he focused on in a desperate attempt to keep the thoughts at bay. Is Essentosh, the Element Games. An international tournament between the three empires, Vesk, Pharaoh, and of course Arns. It was no modest affair. The Essentosh was made up of 36 magicians, 1,000 wealthy spectators willing to make the journey, and, of course, the royal guests. The prince and princess from Vesk, the king's brother from Pharaoh. By tradition, the tournament was hosted by the capital of the previous winner, and thanks to Casimir Vazarin's prowess and Rye's vision, London would be the dazzling centerpiece of this year's games. And at the center, Rye's crowning achievements, the first-ever floating arenas. Tents and stages blossomed all across the city, but Rye's deepest pride was reserved for those three stages being erected not on the banks, but on the river itself. They were temporary, yes, and would be torn down again when the tournament was over. But they were also glorious. Works of art, statues on the scale of stadiums. Rye had commissioned the best metal and earthworkers in the kingdom to build his magnificent arenas. Bridges and walkways were being crafted around the palace, and from above they resembled golden ripples across the Isle's red water. Each stadium was an octagon, canvas stretched like sails over a skeleton of stone. On top of this body, the arenas were covered, the first in sculpted scales, the second in fabric feathers, the third in grassy fur. As Rye watched, massive dragons carved of ice were being lowered into the river to circle the eastern arena, while canvas birds flew like kites above the central one, caught in a perpetual wind. And to the west, eight magnificent stone lions marked the stadium's posts, each caught in a different pose, a captured moment in the narrative of predator and prey. He could have simply numbered the platforms, Rye supposed, but that would have been woefully predictable. No, the Essentosh demanded more. Spectacle. That's what everyone expected, and spectacle was certainly something Rye knew how to deliver. But this wasn't just about putting on a show. Kel could tease all he liked, but Rye did care about his kingdom's future. When his father put him in charge of the tournament, he'd been insulted. He'd thought the Essentosh a glorified party, and as good as Rye was at entertaining, he'd wanted more. More responsibility, more power. And he'd told the king as much.
"Ruling is a delicate affair," his father had chided. "Every gesture carries purpose and meaning. This tournament is not only a game. It helps to maintain peace with our neighboring empires, and it allows us to show them our resources without implying any threat."
The king had laced his fingers.
"Politics is a dance until the moment it becomes a war, and we control the music."
And the more Rye thought on it, the more he understood. The Moresh had been in power for more than 100 years, since before the War of the Empires. The Ostra elite loved them, and none of the royal Vestra were bold enough to challenge their reign, solid as it was. That was the benefit of ruling for more than a century. None could remember what life was like before the Moresh came to power. It was easy to believe the dynasty would never end. But what of the other empires? No one spoke of war, no one ever spoke of war, but whispers of discontent reached like fog across the borders. With 7 children, the Vescans were reaching for power and the king's brother was hungry. It was only a matter of time before Lord Solinar muscled his way onto the Faroean throne, and even if Vescan Pharaoh had their sights on each other, the fact remained that Arnes sat squarely between them. And then there was Kel. As much as Rye joked with his brother about his reputation, it was no joke to Pharaoh or Vesk. Some were convinced Kel was the keystone of the Arnesian Empire, that it would crumble and fall without him at its center. It didn't matter if it was true. Their neighbors were always searching for a weakness because ruling an empire was about strength, which was really the image of strength. The Essentosh was the perfect pedestal for such a display. A chance for Arnes to shine. A chance for Rye to shine, not only as a jewel, but as a sword. He had always been a symbol of wealth. He wanted to be a symbol of power. Magic was power, of course, but it wasn't the only kind. Rai told himself he could still be strong without it. His fingers tightened on the balcony's rail. The memory of Holland's gift flickered through his mind. Months ago, he had done something foolish, so foolish it had nearly cost him and his city everything, just to be strong in the way Kell was. His people would never know how close he'd come to failing them. And more than anything else, Rai Maresh wanted to be what his people needed. For a long time, he thought they needed the cheerful, rakish royal. He wasn't ignorant enough to think that his city was free of suffering, but he used to think, or perhaps he only wanted to think, that he could bring a measure of happiness to his people by being happy himself. After all, they loved him. But what befitted a prince would not befit a king. Don't be morbid, he thought. His parents were both in good health, but people lived and died. That was the nature of the world. Or at least, that was how it should be. The memories rose like bile in his throat. The pain, the blood, the fear, and finally the quiet and the dark. The surrender of letting go, and being dragged back. The force of it like falling, a terrible, jarring pain when he hit the ground. Only he wasn't falling down. He was falling up, surging back to the surface of himself and... Prince Rai! He blinked and saw his guard Tolnurse standing in the doorway, tall and stiff and official. Rai's fingers ached as he pried them from the icy railing. He opened his mouth to speak and tasted blood. He must have bitten his tongue. Sorry, Kell, he thought. It was such a peculiar thing, to know your pain was tethered to someone else's, that every time you hurt, they felt it, and every time they hurt, it was because of you. These days, Rai always seemed to be the source of Kell's suffering, while Kell himself walked around as if the world was suddenly made of glass. All because of Rai. It wasn't even, in the end, wasn't balanced, wasn't fair. Rai held Kell's pain in his hands, while Kell held Rai's life in his.
Are you all right? Pressed the guard. You look pale.
Rai took up a glass of tea, now cold, and rinsed the metallic taste from his mouth, setting the cup aside with shaking fingers.
Tell me, Tolnurse, he said, feigning lightness, am I in so much danger that I need not one but two men guarding my life?
Rai gestured to the first guard, who still stood pressed against the cold stone exterior.
Or have you come to relieve poor Vis before he faints on us?
Tolnurse looked to Vis and jerked his head. The other guard gratefully ducked back through the patio doors and into the safety of the room. Tolnurse didn't take up a spot along the wall, but stood before Rai at attention. He was dressed, as he always was, in full armor, his red cape billowing behind him in the cold wind, gold helmet tucked under his arm. He looked more like a statue than a man, and in that moment, as in many moments, Rai missed his old guards, Gen and Parrish. Missed their humor and their casual banter and the way he could make them forget that he was a prince. And sometimes the way they could make him forget, too.
Don't be contrary, thought Rai. You cannot be the symbol of power and an ordinary man at the same time. You have to choose. Choose right.
The balcony suddenly felt crowded. Rai freed the blueprints from the table and retreated into the warmth of his chambers. He dumped the papers on a sofa, and he was crossing to the sideboard for a stronger drink when he noticed the letter sitting on the table. How long had it been there? Rai's gaze flicked to his guards. Vis was standing by the dark wood doors, busying himself with a loose thread on his cape. Tolnurse was still on the balcony, looking down at the tournament construction with a faint crease between his brows. Rai took up the paper and unfolded it. The message, scrawled in small black script, wasn't in English or Arnesian, but Kaz Avnis, a rare border dialect Rye had been taught several years before. He'd always had a way with languages, as long as they belonged to men and not magic. Rye smiled at the sight of the dialect, as clever as using code and far less noticeable. The note read,
"Prince Rye, I disapprove wholeheartedly and maintain the hope, however thin, that you will both regain your senses. In the event that you do not, I have made the necessary arrangements. May they not come to haunt me. We will discuss the cost of your endeavors this afternoon. Maybe the steams will prove clarifying. Regardless of your decision, I expect a substantial donation will be made to the London Sanctuary when this is over. Your servant, Elder and Arvin Essen, Tirin Serenz."
Rye smiled and set the note aside as bells chimed through the city, ringing out from the sanctuary itself across the river.
"Maybe the steams will prove clarifying."
Rye clapped his hands, startling the guards.
"Gentlemen," he said, taking up a robe, "I think I'm in the mood for a bath."